is at this stage of the retreat, it's always like to give like insight-based talks which illustrate more of the map rather than the flashlight. Remember that seminar I had of the finding the treasure, you need the map, you need the flashlight. The map is the wisdom teachings, the understanding of what's going on, the nature of the mind, the nature of the world. And the flashlight is the power of the mind, going through meditation. And those two together will lead you to the treasure. And even though that today's talk will be more on the map, just I would say once again that you cannot really separate the map from the flashlight. You can't separate the wisdom teachings from the meditation, because these wisdom teachings, they help the meditation. So the particular subject I'm going to go into this morning is what's called the three characteristics of impermanence, anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, or rather suffering, and non-self. And not just describe these as metaphysical doctrines, ideas which you can think about and argue about over coffee tables endlessly, but also just how these can enhance one's meditation. How developing an understanding of them and seeing the world through that framework can actually lead to peaceful states of mind. So we have these three characteristics, very central part of the Buddhist teachings, anicca, dukkha, anatta. People think they know what they mean, but of course they're so profound, they're so deep, you can keep on going on deeper and deeper into these three characteristics. And if you go all the way and understand any one of these in its fullness, you'll understand the other two and you'll be fully enlightened. Because anicca, impermanence, starts first, that's what usually people start contemplating. And of all those three, impermanence, suffering, and not-self, they think that's the easiest one to understand. Because when you start talking about non-self, that's just really sort of deep and just really weird and strange, especially when you say that, you know, your will is not yourself, you didn't decide to do this, you have no choice about coming here, and people get a bit worried about that. But they still get worried, but even less worried about everything is suffering, there's no happiness to be found in this world. Even if you look at a beautiful flower on a nice evening, that's suffering. You say, well, yes, but maybe not. But anicca, impermanence, people think we can understand that one. Everything comes and goes. Now, your favorite programs on the TV, they come and go. Your breakfast comes and goes. For many people, it goes very quickly. As soon as it's on its plate, bang. And we think, oh, retreats come and go, days come and go. But what we think we understand is usually the most profound, the deepest mind source of insight. Really, what we think is easy is in truth very hard and deep. And even impermanence is a change. People really don't see deeply, they think they know it. Yeah, sure, everything's impermanent. We all know it, but really, do we? The point is, with impermanence, there's like two parts to impermanence. Now, there's the part of impermanence which is, I've already mentioned about just things coming and going. You know, the pain and pleasure coming and going, sort of the night and the day constantly changing. We've also got the other part of the impermanence, which is just things vanishing. And that's always a part of impermanence which I like. I've already given one simile of that, of watching the television and seeing all the different programs come and go, but then when you see the television disappear. Another simile is like night and day, night and day. It's either night or it's day, it's either day or it's night. When you see both disappear, the complete emptiness, it's not night, it's not day, it's nothing, then again that gives you another angle on impermanence. But the point with any type of notion of impermanence, the problem is that we can think about it when we want to, but the rest of the time we are in denial. So a lot of the times that we like things to be permanent, and even though in the back of our minds, yeah, it's impermanent, we don't even think about that. And we think that these things are always going to be there. And this part of us does not like to look at impermanence. It gives us another sense of fear. It's strange, but it's part of the arising of insight. The arising of insight normally will always be preceded by fear. You're getting to a place which is very deep, a place which you're hanging on to, you don't want to let go. Fear will come up. If you're courageous, you'll see that. And on the other side of fear and letting go is happiness. You realize that what you are holding on to was not really worth holding on to at all. You're actually holding on to pain, to suffering, to a burden. However, on this side of that insight, it looks as if you're giving away something very precious and you don't want to let it go. I'll just remind you of that simile of the monk who's reborn as a worm in a pile of dung again, which I mentioned on a very early part of this retreat. But that's very similar to what happens to us many times. We're always piles of dung, we've got to put ourselves out of it. Now with this impermanence, the way to actually to really deeply understand it is keeping on applying that term more and more to things in your daily life. It's called that a development in Buddhism, anicca sanya, the perception of impermanence. So whatever we're experiencing, we sort of try and look at it from that angle, always picking out the impermanence in it. This isn't going to last. And that is a bhavana, that's a way of developing. Because the nature of our mind is not to see the impermanence, but to see the permanence in this, to see the stability in this. Because it's like craving, once we get what we want it to last a long time. This is a part of denial. Remember that perception, what it actually is that what we're seeing is not what's there, it's what we're looking for. And we arrange our life, we arrange our situations to be in a constant denial of the truth. One of the obvious examples of that, which you've heard me say before, is like boys and girls going to nightclubs or men and women going to dinner at candlelit restaurants. And why are such places called romantic? Why, when the moon is out at night time, is it a romantic place to go out? And I contemplate that, because I like contemplating all sorts of things in life. And the insight came out very clearly, because remembering the times I used to do those sorts of silly things. The reason is because that when you're at a candlelit restaurant, you just cannot see the person you're going out with. And it's the same in the moonlight. What that does actually, because it's not quite clear, you know, what the person looks like, it gives craving and desire the ability to change all the perceptions and actually look at that sort of ordinary-looking person is like almost like a model who walks on the catwalks, and that person like a great sports star, that man. You actually do that when you go out at night. And people seek to do that. Why is that? Because boys want to go out with beautiful women. Not ordinary women. It's very hard to find a beautiful woman, so they get an ordinary one, but they take her to a candlelit restaurant. They make it look beautiful. And ladies like to go out with strong, hunky men. So in the moonlight, this is not just a joke, this actually works, doesn't it? And that's why sort of in the morning time, people don't go out, you don't say, let's meet for breakfast tomorrow morning. Because if you did that, you'd find out the truth. Now, this is just an example of how perception plays games on us. Because of romanticism, because of our craving, we want to make the world fit into how it should be. So we really want to have this beautiful partner and this relationship which will last forever. So that's why when you get married, till death us do part. What a joke. Because the craving the love doesn't last that long. That is impermanent. It's going to change. But we deny that, don't we? Because of its denial, because we're not looking at the truth, that's the reason why we suffer. Because eventually when the truth comes up to us, it shocks us. The same way that, you know, we have this illusion of perception actually changes. We know that we're all going to die. You know that all of your loved ones are going to die. And all your friends are going to die. Don't you? But why is it then when you get a phone call and you say, you know, one of your friends has died, you, oh no, you get shocked. If you're a real Buddhist and someone rings you up and said, you know, your best friend has died, you said, I thought so. I expected that. That's truth, isn't it? Because we've been thinking all this retreat, I will die, that's for sure, they will die, that's for sure, everyone will die, that's for sure. You've been thinking that, so yeah, I expected that. Plus, the other end of the phone would just really be speechless. But it's true, isn't it, that the fact that we get shocked when somebody, say, dies, the fact that we get shocked, you know, when things disappear, the stock market goes down, or we lose things, or, you know, our car gets stolen. Why is it we get shocked? It's because we forget that these things are impermanent. Why do we get shocked? We go and see a doctor, check up and say, I'm sorry, but you've got a cancer. Why do you get shocked? It's natural to get sick. Sickness is one of the signs of impermanence. Everything's impermanent. So when the doctor says that, I said, yeah, I thought so. I expected that. I think one of these books I read some time ago, there was this, I think, 92-year-old lady went to a hospital. She was absolutely fit, nothing wrong with her whole life. She went to the hospital and the doctor sort of gave her a check-up and she was diagnosed as cancer. She came out saying, why me? Now for us that's funny, but for you it's the same, isn't it? You go in there and say, why me? It's crazy because we don't understand anicca, impermanence. Also, the other part of impermanence, which is nice, once we actually understand that, we keep it in mind, and we actually train our perception to be in line with the truth, not what we want it to be, but how it actually is, that people do die, they can die at any time, people do get sick, they can get sick at any time. All your possessions can disappear from you. The robbery, stock market crashes, taxes or whatever can disappear very quickly. And all you've worked for can suddenly disappear. All of your loved ones can suddenly go. Everything which you think you own can disappear in an instant. If we think like that, and keep, it's fearful to do that, but if we start doing that and get that perception in mind, first of all, when these things do happen, we don't get shocked. And the time from now until it does happen, it means we appreciate those things and we do not take them for granted. That's what anicca does. It might feel to be like fearful. It might look to other people as just being really crazy or just being pessimistic. But the reality of it is that once you see the anicca, the impermanence, once you really contemplate it and get that as the way you look at life, it makes you feel so much happier. You're actually in tune with things rather than, you know, being in this terrible disharmony with life and always trying to fight it and worrying why it doesn't go the way it should go. So the perception of impermanence actually stops a heap of suffering. The more you see it, the more peace and happiness you have in life. So really, that fear is ungrounded. But it's hard to do this. We have to keep on reminding ourselves. We have to keep on developing that perception, whether it's in our husband, our wife, whether it's in our children, whether it's in our possessions, our body, our mind, even our intelligence, that too is going to fade away. According to medical science, as far as I know, that you stop producing neurons after about 20 or something, and then you start losing them by the hundreds, by the thousands every day. So each one of you is over the hill. You're getting less and less intelligent every day as your neurons disappear. In fact, since you started this retreat, thousands of neurons have gone. Sometimes you say these things because sometimes that there are some things very close to us, like our intelligence, that we don't want to let go of. We don't want to get more and more stupid. We don't want to get more and more unable to make clear and wise decisions. We don't want to get closer and closer to senility. But ask your children, and they say, "Mum, Dad, actually you're quite close already." But what's happening here is that we get attached to some things in our body, in our mind, we cherish so much, and we do not want to let them go. Rather than letting these things go gracefully. Our health. Now the health is getting worse and worse and worse as you get closer and closer to your death. I say this very often in our monastery. You see, old people come to our monastery. And they keep on, you know, they have to sit in a chair because, you know, they can hardly walk. Some of them, their legs are gone. And some of them, they can hardly hear. And some of them they can hardly see, their eyes are going, and all the things start to go wrong with old people. But I keep on pointing out to these old people who come to our monastery, yeah, it's true, your legs go when you get old, and your hearing goes, and your eyes go. So there's one thing which never goes, that's your mouth, because old people can speak even more than young people. They can really speak. But anyhow, this is just like the nature of impermanence. So if we actually practicing that perception of impermanence, what it helps us do is to let go of things much more. Because though whatever we own, or whether we think we own, whatever is ours, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from us. It will go. So that stops the attachment to these things. We realize all these things are just visitors. Our husband, our wife is just a visitor into our life. Our children are just visitors. As it says in one of the suttas, they came without being invited, they left without permission. This is like people who come into our lives. Where they came from, we don't know. Where they go to, we can't see. And a person is born, and then they die. So these are just visitors who come and stay with us for a while. And everything else, your body, is just a visitor which you're with for a while, a vehicle which you own, or rather look after for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And same with the thoughts in your mind, they're just visitors. They're even more impermanent. They come, they go, and they change. So we no need to cherish these things. They're just visitors. Our health, our wisdom, that just comes and that just goes. So when we look at these things as impermanent, we don't cherish them, we don't hold on to them, we can let them go. And it's only when we keep cherishing these things that we get this pain when things get taken away from us. And we think, why? This shouldn't happen. Young people shouldn't die. The people I've really put all my emotional concerns into over so many years, they shouldn't just disappear. But they do. And that's sort of the truth of life. So seeing impermanence actually overcomes a great deal of denial in life. And we can actually get much more peaceful, much more free. We don't tie ourselves so much to things which are disappearing even as we see them. So it's Adichya Sanya. So if we see a brick, we see that that's not going to last. So if we see the beautiful day, we know that's not going to last. We see our friends, we know this is not going to last. We see this meditation retreat, we know it's not going to last. Our health is not going to last. So all of our loved ones, they come and they go. As it says, we're born alone and we die alone. But that's actually not a fearful thing once you really get your mind on it and get into it, because it gives a lot of relief. And not so much burdens and baggage in life. But also the other half of impermanence is to know that it's when you have got a good friend, you have got a healthy body, when you're on a nice retreat, you don't waste any minute of it. When you know it's not going to end, you cherish every moment. When it's time for it to end, you let it go, knowing you've done your very best. And you've given your all to that day, to that moment, to that person. And on that parting, there'll always be a sense of happiness and fulfillment. In the same way, very good monk told me some years ago in Sri Lanka, it doesn't really matter how deep you get in your meditation, he said. It doesn't matter how much insight arises. But he said, at the end of the day, before you go to sleep, if you look at what you've been doing all day, and you really have done your very best, you should go to sleep content, because you haven't wasted that day. And it's the same when people ask me that, do I feel sad when somebody dies, especially a close friend or sort of a loved one? And I say, basically, this is actually true, I'm not making this up. If I see someone I've known a long time die, or even known a short time, I'm only sad if they've wasted their life. If they haven't used the opportunities which have been given to them, and they haven't really put effort into what they've been doing, then I feel very sad that they've wasted a life. Or if they haven't been generous and kind and actually given to society, they've just been very selfish and looked after themselves, I feel very sad that a person dies. If a person has really given, and they've been a beautiful person, they've trained themselves, they've given to society, they've developed their own wisdom, and they really use this time wisely, then I feel very happy. It's been a life well lived, well done. That's the difference, with me anyway, between the happiness and sadness when somebody goes. And also with the disappointment or feeling good. If I've done, put everything I've got into what I've been doing, I feel very happy. It doesn't matter how much I achieve. If I don't achieve anything, if I've really given my all, then I feel content. So this is also part of the impermanence. And as one contemplates this more and more, again, the fear disappears, the understanding arises, and more effort comes into the right areas of one's life. That's why that we do such practices of walking meditation saying, I will die, that's for sure. If you want to change it around a little bit, think of your loved one and say, he or she will die, that's for sure. Try that. He will die, that's for sure. He will die, that's for sure. Or she will die, that's for sure. She will die, that's for sure. And see what that does to the mind. It should, I hope, get fear coming up. This doesn't feel like, right, I don't like this. But you know it's true. It's like going to a dentist and taking a tooth out, which is infected, and needs to be taken out. But first of all, it doesn't feel very nice because you're actually challenging a deep attachment there. When actually you get through that fear and say, yeah, it's true, whether it's my son, whether it's my best friend, whether it's my mother, whether it's my husband, my loved one, they will die, that's for sure, they will die, that's for sure. At the other end of that, once you've got through that fear and realize that's actually true, that makes the whole relationship with that person so much richer. Because you have to really care for them. There's no actually opportunity for anger and ill will and all this stupid stuff which wastes so much time between people. You get the perception that this could be the last day. And you treat your husband, your wife, your kid, your parents, or whoever else it is, your loved one, you treat it as if it's your last day together. And every day becomes as if the last day. It becomes that valuable, that important. And you can imagine just how that enriches your relationships, how that enriches your life. It looks at first that this is going to get you really sort of morbid and depressed. But if you go through that, you'll find it makes life so much more happy. It also prepares you. So when it does happen, yeah, I expected that. So this is actually how we can practice this anicca, but we can also go much deeper. When it gets to the meditation, everything which comes up in your meditation, this will pass, that's for sure. So you never get really depressed or upset. When you're meditating and you're having a hard time, a difficult time, nothing's happening, don't worry, this will pass. When we realize it will pass, it takes away a lot of the sting from the unpleasant part of meditation. If you're sitting there and in great pain because your legs are aching or your back is aching, you know that this will pass. As Ajahn Chah said, if you carry on sitting, it's either going to get better or you're going to die. This is a great place to die because the monk's already here, you can get a funeral on the cheap. And what that actually does, that actually makes the moment more important. And you know how hard it sometimes is staying in the present moment. Very often we start thinking of the future, worrying about the past. It means we don't value the present moment. Impermanence actually makes us value the present moment much more. You don't know how many more present moments you have. And so this moment becomes vital. Anyone who's close to death, it's lovely actually to see them and be with people close to death, because all the past and the future just doesn't concern them so much. The present is so valuable. They really want to spend this time with you. They don't waste any time. So actually that perception of impermanence actually really helps come into the present moment. And it also clears away a lot of the stupid thoughts we have. And quite frankly, all the thoughts you've had during this retreat, all the things which have come into your mind, have they really been useful? Or have they really been a lot of rubbish? And you wonder, what am I thinking about this for? Isn't this stupid? That's actually why when I was a young monk, I used to go and visit these really great monks. And many of these monks could actually read your minds. That's why I didn't like visiting these monks. I thought, oh no, I hope they don't read my mind today. Maybe some days, if you're nice and prepared, but some days, I mean, would you like Ajahn Brahm to read your mind? And tell everybody else? So a lot of the time, sort of, many of these thoughts which go through our mind are really wasting time. Sometimes we call it killing time. And that's because we have forgotten impermanence. We've forgotten how valuable is this moment, and how valuable is just, if you're going to think at all, think thoughts which are really going to get you somewhere. Think about the meditation, or even better, be silent. So that sense of impermanence actually does help really strengthen the meditation. But the other part of impermanence is not just seeing things rise and fall, but things actually fall and disappear. It gives you the opportunity to really let things go. To realize that things can disappear from you and you don't need to linger and keep holding on to them. Because a lot of the time we can allow them to fall, but we don't let them stay fallen. We make them rise again. So we might stop hearing and everything gets quiet, but we want to make that rise again and we start listening. Or the body gets very, very still and we get a bit concerned, so we want to make it come back to life again. We go looking for things in our body to turn on the body sense again. We can only look at impermanence as being this beautiful thing which can allow things to disappear, allow things to go. We can let go of all the things, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, all of my thoughts, all of the feelings in the body, even my beloved nimitta, all of that can disappear. When we understand impermanence, it's much easier to let these things go. You know the story of that Kisa Gotami. He had a child, was dead, and she wouldn't let it go. She, even though it was dead, she kept on thinking it was alive, and trying to get medicine to make it alive. And you all know that story. You wouldn't let things go. Sometimes that happens when people lose a very close relation. And they're in denial for a long time, they're thinking they're going to just wake up or just reappear someday. They can't let it go. In the same way that we can't even let our thoughts go, because we cherish them so much. We can't let our body go, because we cherish it so much. The perception of impermanence is that which can allow us to let things go, and even to let our body go, to let our thoughts go, even to let nimittas go. Impermanence challenges attachments and unties the knots, and allows us to be free. So you can develop that perception of impermanence very often. Just keep saying that, you know, this is going to change, this will change, this will change. Any difficulty in life, this will change. This will change. The future, that's changeable, therefore it's uncertain. The past is changeable, we can't rely upon it. Everything is changing. Everything is passing away. So let it pass away. If you could really understand impermanence, anicca, to that degree, there should be no problem at all of getting into deep meditation. If you get stuck in meditation, if there's an obstacle, focus on that impermanence. This, which I'm experiencing now, is going to go. It's not stable. It's subject to change. It's subject to disappearance. Whatever this is. And then that might just unlock the attachment. You know it's going to go, you can allow it to go. It's free to go. And sometimes it just go. Whatever that obstacle is. The thoughts coming in your mind, these are just thoughts, they come and go. They're not real, they're not true. Feelings, they just come and go. Not real, they're not true. You can let them go then. You know the biggest problem with pain? You think it's always going to be like this. It's never going to go. That's the illusion of pain. If you knew whatever pain it was only going to last, say, for 10 minutes, you'd always be able to endure. If you really knew absolutely it was going to disappear in 10 minutes, it'd be no problem. But with pain, we always think the illusion comes up. I can't stand this any longer. I can't stand this any longer. It's the any longer part. The longer part, it's going to go on and on and on and on forever. That's what stops us enduring. So this is actually how we can use impermanence. So if you go right all the way through, and everything which we own, our body, our mind, all of that is impermanent. Even the knower, to see that as impermanent, comes and goes. Consciousness, the doer, to see that come and go. To apply impermanence right throughout. This is where the Buddha said everything is impermanent, and sometimes you say everything is impermanent. What people really mean is everything out there is impermanent, but me in here, knowing all this, I'm always here. The problem with attachment, you always try and find some place, somewhere in the cosmos, and usually in the internal cosmos, where you try and make a stable, permanent fixture. Where you can, as it were, hang your hat on, the hat of self. So in meditation you go right to the very center of what you take to be you, and see even that is impermanent. It rises and falls, it comes and it goes. Any God comes and goes. Any ultimate self, cosmic self, it just comes and goes. So if you go that deep inside, you see there is nothing which you cannot apply that label to, impermanence. To see everything is impermanent. Once you see that that is the rule, that is the law of things, it's like the husband you cherish. And in this simile, the husband stands for that last citadel of self, the knower or the doer. That which you cherish and really hung on to, cleave to, as a sense of identity. When you see that it is of the nature to come and go, you can let it go. When that loved one dies, you can let it go. And there's no fear anymore. The fear of letting go of consciousness of letting go of the doer disappears. The fear of non-self has vanished, and you can allow things to stop. The door to ending samsara is then open. So this is actually how that anicca goes like very deep. That's why that in the suttas they say anyone who develops that as their main path, which leads to the complete untying of all the knots which tie you to rebirth, is someone who gets the what's called that the desireless liberation. That one, they call it the signless liberation. The signless, because they cannot stick any label on anything. So that's a signless liberation. You cannot stick anything on it, because whatever you stick it on, it just falls away. And that becomes one of the three paths into enlightenment. The second path, impermanence goes that deep, and don't think you understand impermanence yet. When you say everything is impermanent, what you're really saying is everything is out there is impermanent. You're still keeping a little store of things which you assume to be permanent, that which you hang your identity on. The second part of the three characteristics of resistance is like suffering. And that, of course, is also something which goes extremely deep. Everything is dukkha. So what that means is, if you really understand now, that all these things which you look for happiness in the world, say, is always going to disappoint you. That's par for the course. So we spend most of our life looking for some happiness, some fulfillment, and we find that actually it's in the reaching for that where we have this thing called hope. Hope that this is actually going to be what creates my happiness. This new job, when I pay off the mortgage, when I settle down in this relationship, when I become enlightened, then I'm going to be happy ever after. Or whatever else it is, you know, you think is going to be that permanent happiness. Whereas the Buddha was actually saying that sort of you might search for that, but again you're searching for something which doesn't exist. And because of that, there's a statue in this monastery in Thailand of this which Ajahn Chah would always imitate. And there's a photo of him imitating this in the first Vihara we had in London. And this statue's got his hands up in the air like this, with a great smile on his face, and he's really pissed out. And the caption is, like, joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. And it's like a sort of a Zen code. This is Dinky Dai Theravada. Sort of, joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. That realizing of dukkha is actually just so liberating. You think of it just so pessimistic, everything is suffering. Sort of, eating is suffering, looking at a flower is suffering, watching a baby being born is suffering, seeing a sunset is suffering, hearing the Dhamma is suffering, getting enlightened is suffering, everything is suffering. Sounds crazy, doesn't it? So why bother? Exactly, let go. So what that's actually saying is, joy at last to know there's no suffering and no happiness in the world. It means that all of that craving, all of that desire, all of that wanting, all of that expecting, all of that striving, all of that struggling, you finally realize that you've been wasting so much time. And it's actually the wanting just creates what we call the double dukkha, the double suffering. Whenever you have suffering in life, say you've got pain in the body, that's called single dukkha. Whenever the thought comes up, I don't want this, that's called double dukkha. I'm sure you can understand that, because everything in life, you've got the physical suffering and you've got the mental response to that. Someone calls you an idiot, okay, that not nice to hear. That's dukkha. Why do they call vidya? That's double dukkha. And sometimes that goes to treble dukkha, quadruple dukkha, and multiple dukkha. So the point is there that if you realize, oh, this is just dukkha, I can expect this. I can expect people to call me names and call me stupid things. I can expect sometimes people to come and say, what a marvelous retreat you've done, Ajahn Brahman. Someone else comes and say, you know, that's the worst retreat. You're just the most incompetent monk I've ever met in my whole life. I'm never going to come to any of these retreats ever again. Not only that, I'm going to complain to the Buddhist Society. I said, oh yeah, expected that. Because this is actually life, isn't it? Yeah. Hands up, anyone who only gets praise and no blame at all. Even the Buddha said, even as a Buddha, I still get people blaming me. There's not one person in this world who just gets only praise. That's half the course. Happiness at last, to know there's no absolute praise is available in this world. So why do I work so hard to please people? Why do I work so hard to please my husband and to look after my wife, and all I'm going to get is the same amount of praise and blame? Basically, that's all you do get. No matter how hard you try. How hard have you tried sometimes? And all you get is criticism at work. Part of the course, I expect that. So instead of working so hard to try and please people and get praise, you should do it just for the sake of doing it. Because it needs to be done. You want to be kind. You want to help people. It don't matter what people say about you. What people say about me, that's their problem. I'm just going to do what I think is right, what I want to do, what I think is going to be happy and going to serve the world. So that way that happiness at last, or joy at last, there's no happiness in the world. And it's true. And it gives you that freedom. And it stops the great search for the best meal, or the best partner, or the best sex, or the best movie, or the best this, or the best that. Sometimes as monks, they go around looking for the best monasteries, or the best teacher. And you just keep on going around and around and around. And of course, once you see that there's no happiness to be found in the world, the result of that perception of suffering, is that you stop looking into the future for your happiness. You stop craving, you stop struggling. Because you know there's nothing to be found there. The store is empty. When you stop trying to buy things in this empty store, then joy at last. I stop looking, I stop searching. I stop grasping. I stop going off into the future or the past. There's no happiness to be found. That thing which you think is jhanas and enlightenment isn't the real thing. Stop looking for jhanas. Stop looking for enlightenment. That's actually looking for suffering. That's looking for the tortoise with the mustache. Stop looking for these things. And then you stop looking, you get still. You come to peace. And there are all the jhanas you ever want. And there is enlightenment. In the non-looking into the future, in the non-craving, in the non-grasping. That's why sometimes the people get into this stages of enlightenment and jhanas, because they get so much suffering. They keep trying to get rid of it this way, trying to get rid of it that way. They're trying to, like I was saying with that toothache story, they're trying to walk meditation, sit meditation, chanting, anything to get rid of this terrible toothache. And she said, there's no way I'm going to get rid of this toothache. It's there. I accept it. Joy at last to know there's no release from toothache. And that's what happens. Wow. As soon as I stop trying to fight it, it's bliss. Joy at last to know there's no happiness in this world. As soon as you stop fighting, and you rest, it's joy. I don't mean just equanimity, I mean bliss. Enlightenment is bliss. So this is actually where you see all this suffering in the world, all these things which you've been trying to search for, grasp for, struggle for. It's not worth it. Actually, it's a good place to put in this story, which I mentioned to a couple of people. It's one of my favourite stories of the Mexican fisherman and the Harvard business school graduate. This Harvard Business School graduate was on holiday in the south of Mexico on the coast. And he saw this fisherman sort of come in early, you know, just after, well, just actually before lunchtime. And he saw this fisherman sort of unload his boat. He had just a few fish in the boat. And this Harvard businessman, MBA, sort of decided to, you know, he had a few hours and decided to help this poor guy. He said, look, said, no, I know all about business. Sort of, you know, this fish you're getting now, it's not that much, is it? He said, no, it's not that much, senor, but you know, it's enough to feed my family and also to sell a little bit so I could, you know, go in the evening to play a little guitar and drink a bit of, what do they drink in Mexico? Tequila with my friends. He said, it's enough for me, just now, just after I've cleaned up my boat, and I go home, have a nice lunch, have a siesta, and I spend the afternoon playing with my kids, and I go down to the bar in the evening with my mates, play a guitar, have a bit of tequila. Week after week after week, with that money you save, you can actually buy a second boat. And then you'd be able to get even more fish. And like I guarantee, only for about 1 or 2 years, you'd be able to actually hire a lot of crew. And maybe in about 5 or 6 years, by investing your profits back into your business, you can actually probably get a whole fleet of fishing boats. He said, but senor, what would I do then? He said, then you can actually move your business to Mexico City and diversify. Or even you may be able to go to New York. And then once your business is really big, you can do a corporate buyout, front your thing on a stock exchange, and you can actually make many millions of dollars. And I guarantee you, if you follow this plan, in 10 years, you'll be a multimillionaire. And then the fisherman said, but senor, what would I do then? Once you've got a multimillionaire, then you can retire to a nice fishing village, buy a small little boat, just go out in the morning and get a few fish, and then have a nice siesta every day. And in the evening, just play a bit of guitar, and you'll be free to have a bit of tequila in your bar with your mates. He said, senor, I'm doing that already. And that's a lovely Mexican fisherman story. Did you get the punchline there? So we go searching for all this wealth, 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 so we can live simply and retire. And that's why I caught on to that when I was only 23, 24. I retired at 23, 24. Look at me. So I've got a beautiful country estate. I've got a townhouse. And I've got all these servants bringing me breakfast every morning. So that's years ago, actually, when I went to, in a part of Devon, there's another religious community, it was a Hindu community, and they had this beautiful house, it was like a dream sort of cottage in Devon, very beautiful, very pretty. I remember this person actually turned around and said to me, you've got to give up everything in the world to be able to live in a place like this. I always remember that saying, you've got to give up everything in the world to live in a nice monastery. But people think they've got to get all this money to be able to live in a nice mansion. You're going to make all this money to live like the poor Mexican fisherman. Understand? Because that's like suffering. We go looking for things in the world. When we realize, alas, there's no happiness in the world, then we can live much more simply. We don't keep on striving so much. Because really what you're working for is more suffering. Bigger salary, bigger suffering. More things, more burdens, more suffering, isn't it? Come on, be honest. So happiness and life, there's no joy at life, and there's no happiness in the world. The biggest match, and you've got the most money in the world, people get very disappointed, because when they get all these things, they realize it's not enough. This is what I said the other day, when somebody offers me sort of $20 just for you, Ajahn Brahm, this is not for the monastery, not for the mountain monastery, not for the Buddhist society. Now you give all these talks, you work so hard, I really want, what do you need for $20? Please don't do that to me. Before, I'm always happy, but once you say $20, it's never enough. Is it? That's why because you're all great meditators in this retreat, suppose I gave each one of you the correct lottery number for the Australian or next year's lottery, and you were all sort of got $1 million each, would that be enough? It wouldn't. You try and get on the next retreat to get another lottery number next year. It's never enough. That's the trouble, is because it's never happiness. So this joy at last, and there's no happiness in the world, is actually a very beautiful way of talking about the Buddha's teaching on suffering, on dukkha. So what it actually does, it means it stops all craving. Instantly. And this is actually very often what happened to people when they became enlightened. It is just a turn. They don't need to, they're not that far away. As soon as they stop craving, I mean really stop craving, really stop wanting, just have that little knot, it's stop. That movement of the mind, looking for happiness out here, looking for happiness over there. As soon as you stop that craving, then happiness comes. And you realize that the reason why you've been struggling, suffering, not fulfilled in the life is because you've been looking over there rather than just being where you are. That's actually what suffering is. And sometimes you look at all the things which you delighted in the world and you realize that what you thought was happiness wasn't. What people cherish in the world, what they aspire towards in the world, is not happiness. This is actually one of the sayings in the Buddha. So what the enlightened one says happiness, the world says is suffering. What the world says is happiness, the enlightened one says is suffering. The enlightened one says happiness, the world says is suffering. Complete opposite way around. That's why when you go back to your workplace and they say, do you have a nice Easter? Do you have a nice holiday? What do you do? I spent all day just sitting on this cushion with my legs aching, my back aching, thoughts wondering what I was doing. And they said, what did you do that for? And say, well, I got a lot of happiness. If you tell people you went to a monastery for your holidays, or you went to a retreat, they think you're actually crazy. And when they actually tell you actually paid for this, they think you're dumb. Because what you know as happiness, they say is suffering. But you ask them what they did for their holidays. And they say they went to this theme park where they sort of went to this death drop and they sort of watched this movie which scared the life out of them. And then they sort of had this music which was just so sad. And they say, oh, it's just wonderful. And that's stupid, that's crazy, that's suffering. I went out and got drunk. Went to this great party, which was really great. Well, actually, I don't remember most of it, but that's happiness in the world, isn't it? What they think. I think that's suffering. So, I mean, this is actually what the difference between enlightened people and unenlightened people is what you take to be happiness and what you take to be suffering. So, this is actually what suffering is, what dukkha is. If you actually really understand that suffering, you let go a lot. Because why would you ever hold on to things which hurt? Which create more problems, which create more difficulties in life? Why do you sort of hurt yourself so much? By craving, by wanting, by looking for this and looking for that. You've got all the happiness you want, and you throw it all away looking for something else. All the peace you have, how much do you really need to survive in this world? I'm not talking what the banks say or what sort of the advertisements say, what you need to be happy. How much do you really need to be happy? I know this is bad for the economy, but so that you can live with far less. When you live with far less, you're far happier. You're less burdened. Especially don't try and keep up with the Joneses. When I go to visit other monasteries, I don't think my monastery is better than your monastery. We've got meditation paths which are covered, you have it, ha ha ha. That sort of stuff, keeping up the joke, right out of the bigger than your house. I've got the, you know, the new DVD, you have it. That's the stupid stuff, that gets more suffering. So just keep it simple in your life, and that stops a lot of suffering. And actually the way you do this is actually stage by stage by stage by stage. You live a little bit more simply. Yeah, you know, the Buddha was right, it's easier. a little bit more simply, more easier, it means you can retire younger. Now, without having to work all your life to pay off this mortgage for this huge house. People start off their life, you know, with just a small house, or maybe an apartment, that's all they afford, but they can just, you know, leave university or college. A small little apartment they share with a few mates. And then, you know, when they start getting a bit of money, they get maybe a bigger apartment. When they get married, they have to have a proper house. When they have kids, they have to add on a few rooms, or it's not big enough, they have to buy a bigger house. And then when they get a bit more wealthy, they get even a bigger house yet in a better suburb. I see there's a lot of people, and they keep on telling me, they say, this is my last house, because this is an investment, they say. But as soon as their kids leave, the house is too big, so they have to get a smaller house. And then when they get the smaller house, again, it's still sort of, you know, they're getting really old, they don't need a big house anymore. Even that size, they get a smaller house. And then when they die, they get the house which is only 6 foot long, 6 foot wide. That's the only house they needed anyway. Isn't it crazy? This is what we do to ourselves. They can retire early if you know how to live simply. So this is actually understanding that suffering, and just understanding the reason it's suffering. Yeah, double suffering is because we go over there. We want something else. That's suffering. Suffering is the gap between what you want and the way things are. When the way things are is different the way you want them to be, that's called suffering. It's very easy to overcome suffering, because that gap, the way things are, the way you want them to be, how do we solve that problem? The way things are, the way we want them to be. We usually try and change the way things are. To bring the way things are into line with what we want it to be. We want to take our husband, our wife, and put them not the way they are, the way we want them to be. Our body, not the way it is, the way we want our body to be. Healthy, fit. Our meditation, not the way it is, the way we want our meditation to be. Life, not the way life is, but the way we want life to be. And that's just like trying to, to change mountains. That's like King Canute, you know, sort of stood in the waves and say, tide, go back. That's called suffering. So instead of actually trying to change the way things are, to bring into life the way we want it to be, the obvious thing to do is to change the way we want things to be and bring them into line with the way things are. I'm really tired this morning. Just be tired. And there's no problem then. Now I feel like going to sleep. I should go to sleep because, you know, it's in my meditation retreat. I've got to fight through this. It's suffering, isn't it? You're tired, and go and have a rest. If the mind's all over the place, and you're trying hard to focus on the present moment, focus on a bit, how about stopping changing the way you want it to be and bring it into line with what it is? Just be content to be thinking all over the place. Try that, if you've got the gut to do that. You'll find everything starts to stop. And you find all this hard work about trying to meditate and trying to watch the breath and trying to get into deep meditation. You give up. I'm a hopeless meditator. Then you learn how to be a good meditator. You've given up. All those stories of Ananda I told last night, trying to get enlightened and then just giving up and going to sleep. You got enlightened then. So, if you really want to get enlightened, because there's only a day or two left, try going to sleep. That's what he got in line. So it's just letting go, letting go, letting go, letting go. And that's opposite of suffering. All suffering is due to craving, the second noble truth. The last of the three characters of existence is non-self. That is always described by the Buddha, not me, not mine, not a self. That's beautiful teaching. Because not me, not my, not a self, means not my problem. You know what happens in work? You know, when somebody else goes up, not my problem. Not my problem, not my problem, not my problem. Isn't that great? If you could say that to your body when it's aching, not my problem. Your meditation when it's always all over the place, not my problem. Now, your responsibility is to become enlightened in this retreat. And at the outside, you've got other responsibilities. In this retreat, to become enlightened. That's your major responsibility. So whatever happens, you know, it's sort of not my problem. If that really happens, no thought will come into your mind. But all these thoughts are problems you try and solve. Things you try and work out. Whether it's your work, whether it's your family, it's what your brother is doing, what the person next to you is doing. Not my problem. All these thoughts, all these feelings, even your breath. It's rough, it's smooth, not my problem, I just watch it. The nimitta comes and goes, not my problem. So what you're saying is not mine, not mine. That's actually how I started off this retreat, by encouraging you to say, whatever you experience, not mine, not mine, not mine. If you do that, when it's not mine, you let it go. The nature of things is to disappear. The only reason they stay is because you're somehow holding on to these. That you've got a vested interest in these. They are yours. It's your problem, your responsibility, your Buddhist society, your monastery, my body, my meditation. Not your problem. When that happens, it's not mine. Everything gets nice and easy, doesn't it? You just drift through in every moment. But you've got to be very decisive with not my problem meditation. Because everything has to be applied to not my problem. Not just the rotten part, but the nice part as well. Nothing belongs to me. Nothing belongs to me. Nothing belongs to me. You sit here, this body, it doesn't belong to me. If you can really follow that, it will disappear. In the suttas, the Buddha gave this beautiful example of anatta. And it was, he was walking through the Jeta Grove, the Jetavana monastery where we went to a couple of months ago. And he saw these twigs, the leaves, and cut grass lying by the side there. He had some monks with him. He said, "Monks, see these twigs, leaves and grass over there? What would you do if some villagers came along and gathered all these twigs and leaves and grass together into a big pile, set light to it and burnt it to ashes? Then they took the ashes and they threw them up into the air and they went in all directions, really got lost. What would you do?" The monk said, "Nothing. It's not our problem. It doesn't belong to us." The Buddha smiled and said, "Monks, what would they do? What would you do if the villagers came and take you together, put you in a big pile, set fire to you, and actually all your ashes, instead of giving them to your relations, threw them to the four winds, so they got scattered all over the place. What would you do?" And the monks, according to the story anyway, they gave their answer, "We won't have any problems at all. No problems. It doesn't belong to us." They're good monks. That was the teaching of anatta. And in one of these poems, this monk was aspiring, when will I be able to look at this body and this mind as well, just like the leaves and the twigs and the grass and the Jeta Grove? When will I be able to be fully detached, to know that this is not mine, not my body, not my thoughts, not my perceptions, not my feelings, not even my consciousness? To be able to let it all go. When will that happen? And later on in his poem, it happened. He let go, became fully enlightened. This is what I mean, it's not my problem. You make a problem with this body. You've got to look after it, but now make a big problem. When it's time to go, chuck it away. It doesn't belong to you. That's, in Australia at the moment, there's this big thing with autopsies and people taking the body parts here and putting them over there, because that person in Sydney, Dr. Hilton, he used to be the chief pathologist here, and when we saw a couple of autopsies, he was the one actually performing those autopsies for us, and he was a really nice guy. I remember sort of meeting him. There was a big trouble because people get offended when they have an autopsy, their loved one is dead, and they take a bit out here and a bit out there to put in bottles for future research, because they really think that those parts belong to the family. It's crazy. They don't belong to the family. I mean, if they get burnt, they belong to the ground. If they get buried, they belong to the worms and the beetles. You can't keep these things anyway. This actually idea of like owning your body is really sort of, it's really strange to me. That's why, you know, all my organs, anyone could have them. But don't get my nose, because that's not what keeps on exploding, it keeps on sneezing. But you can have my brain. I want to see, prove to you that that's not going to be your afterwards. The mind, okay. The other simile which I give about Anatta, which is really nice, is the simile of like the driverless bus. Because this is like a simile for life. Like, it's an old metaphor of life being on a journey. It's like you're in a bus. And sometimes this bus goes through beautiful countryside, you're having a wonderful time. You're looking through the window and everything looks so delightful. Because you're having a nice time, because of attachment, you tell the bus driver, slow down, even stop, I really want to enjoy this, I want to stay here as long as possible. Sometimes that bus driver does slow down and stop, but other times it just actually speeds up and it doesn't last as long as it should do. And you get very frustrated with this bus driver. Other times you're going through really rotten scenery, you know, toxic waste dumps, goodness knows what else. So you want to hurry out of here. So you tell the bus driver, quick, get out of here. And sometimes the bus driver does go quickly. But a lot of the time the bus driver slows down and even stops. And you get really frustrated. In that simile, so the bus driver is this doer, your idea of you. And the beautiful scenery is when you're having a wonderful time. You have a lot of happiness and things are going so well. And you say, slow down, I really want to enjoy this. I want to keep this for a long time. Sometimes that happens, you know, the happiness lasts, but often you want it to last for a long time and it just disappears. Now this doer just messes it all up and it goes. And sometimes you're in pain, depression, things are going really wrong, having a terrible time, and you're this doer, you say, get out of here, come on. Sometimes it works, but a lot of times it doesn't work, and all the pain and suffering lasts much longer than it should. And you get very frustrated with this doer, this choice, this stupid. Now, you stupid Brahm, why don't you learn how to get out of here quicker? Why do you stay much longer in the bliss? And so, in this metaphor, the person wants to find out exactly who this doer is, to train this doer, so that you can get just happiness, or mostly happiness, but not so much suffering. A lot of people in meditation, that's what they come here for, to try and get more happiness and less suffering. So they want to find out about this doer, how to train this doer to be able to let go of the suffering, get out quickly, be able to stay longer in the happiness. They don't really want to be enlightened, they just want to be happier, solve their worldly problems. So they come here and they've got to find out that doer, first of all, to really instruct them, and to tell them what to do. And in this meditation, deeper and deeper into the mind, you come closer and closer to the doer. This thing called will, choice. Because this is the heart of it, isn't it? This is actually what's controlling what you're doing. This is actually what's making you sort of think, making you worry, making you go here, making you do this. This will, this choice. Eventually, you've got to find out this thing so you can actually train it properly. And when you actually, in the simile, it's like finding the bus driver's seat. Now, the seat of will. Who's actually driving this thing you call your life? And after a long search, and a lot of meditation, you finally come deep into the mind, through the jhanas, and you come to the seat of the will. You come to the bus driver's actual seat. You, the self, the doer, the motivator. And this is where you get the shock of your, not of your life, of your many lives. The shock of your whole existence through samsara. When you see that bus driver's seat is empty. Nobody there. Nobody driving this bus. Empty, sunyata. You see anatta, the empty seat in the top of the bus. You know what the result of that is? In Buddhism, it's called like the end of craving. What it means is you go back to your seat, you sit down, and you stop complaining. Because there's no one to complain to. You're suffering, you stop complaining. There's no one to complain to about suffering, about pain, about being sick or dying. When things are going well, you don't say, stop, make it last a long time. You know that's hopeless. It doesn't get you anywhere. So you sit down there and you take it as it comes. With equanimity.
If it's an empty seat, who sees?
Who sees? Even that's empty as well. It's not who, it's what. And it's not what sees, it's just seeing. It's just a process, not a thing. This is like the word I am. That's not a sentence. That's not an idea. It's just a fiction. Because there's this cartoon which I remember Thich Nhat Hanh sort of pointed out some time ago. There was Descartes was in front of this horse, and Descartes was saying, I think, therefore I am. And the horse answered, no, I am what? What are you? Because I am is not enough. Say, I am what? You can't just say I am. I am what? Because I am something is a sentence. I am Singaporean, that's a sentence. I am mad, that's a sentence. I am happy, that's a sentence. But I am is nothing. It doesn't exist in the world. So what's the last word of that sentence? When you put the last word of a sentence, the whole illusion of self goes out the window. So when you see that bus driver's seat is empty, again, that's like seeing non-self, the doer, the will. What's actually driving that bus driver's seat is cause and effect, is the process, completely conditioned. That's all the things which you've been saying. The reason why I don't get angry at you for interrupting is because you've got no choice. You had to do that. I understand that. The reason anyone else does all these things is because they got no choice. Is that really that so? It's going back to the experiences. Another thing which really showed this to me was experiments in hypnotism. Because I already mentioned that when I was at university, I used to go to these lectures, and as well as a witch every year, always used to be a hypnotist come every year. And I always used to go to that lecture as well, because he'd make all these students do funny things. And it was really hilarious sometimes. But this hypnotist would come up there, and when they get you up, they come up here, and they absolutely hypnotize you, and then tell you, sort of, you know, that when he scratches your ear, you'll stand up in the middle of all these students and you'll sing the Singaporean national anthem. So they always give you the post-hypnotic suggestion that you won't remember that instruction. And then during the exercise on the stage with all these students in front of them, this hypnotist would just scratch his ear. And then you'd suddenly burst into this natural anthem, you sing it really loudly. And everyone would start laughing. It was completely ridiculous, because they'd know where that came from. But the interesting part was they'd ask you, why did you do that? Why did you do that thing? And for the person who's actually singing that song, for them they'd be absolutely convinced that they decided to sing that out of their own free will. It would appear like that, it would be no different than anything else they did in life. And it's amazing. If you get hypnotized to do something, afterwards, you don't know you've been hypnotized, you think you're choosing completely freely. You just don't know. Everyone else in the audience knows that's not you decided to do that, the hypnotist told you to. And as soon as you start to see that, they really sort of start to shock you. All these other things I think I am doing out of my own free will. Coming here, you know, deciding whether to have toast or muesli, and what sort of spread you have on you. You really think you chose that? When you start investigating to this, it really gets one scary, but actually quite interesting. Straight away, all this guilt business completely disappears. It's not my fault. That's why I tell people in in Dhammaloka and in the monastery. So because I tell these stupid jokes, it's not my fault. I know, because my father used to do the same. Remember him, he came home one day from work and he said, "Oh, it's just, I just had some really bad news," he said. So I remember this, is the memory of a true story. He came back home and said, "Terrible news." He said, "No, my cousin just had an accident. And he had to have his leg cut off, leg removed, amputated." "That's really bad." You know, I remember my mother and my brother, uncle, you know, just, "Oh, it's terrible." He said, "But what happened in the operation theatre? They messed up, they cut off the wrong leg." And obviously after cutting off the wrong leg, they had to wheel him straight back into the theatre again to cut off the leg they should have cut off in the first place. And he said that, you know, absolute medical malpractice. They made a big mistake. And the friend actually took the hospital to court to sue them. But he lost. He couldn't have lost. That's terrible. And so the father just re-drives in, and then he looked and said, "Yeah, he didn't have a leg to stand on." So the way I tell jokes, it's not me, don't blame me. If you want to blame anyone, go to my father's grave and just blame him. It's his fault. Complete conditioning. Can you actually just see that some of the things you do? Can you see they come from your parents? Can you see some of the things which you actually say, because sometimes come from people like me as well, conditioning you? Can you see they come from, you know, like people you look up to? I should actually publish this one day, but I've got a picture which I got from my mother's home before she threw it away, of me when I was a student. Okay. You wouldn't recognise me. I had big fuzzy hair out here. And where the hair stopped was a big beard. And you know who my hero was? Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, almost unconsciously you were looking like your heroes. And I thought I was being individual and rebellious. That's why, I said this only a couple of weeks ago at Nonamara, we used to have these big rock festivals when I was growing up. And so I rolled up to the Isle of Wight one day in my green velvet trousers. And I thought I was being rebellious, because not many other of my people who lived in Acton at that time had green velvet trousers. And when I went there to this rock festival, I found there was about 30,000 other people also had green velvet trousers. I thought, no, I wasn't being an individual after all. It's just another uniform. And it's sort of, you realise all these choices which you make, sort of a lot of them, and just maybe all of them, completely conditioned. But who is this thing doing the willing? It looks like it's us, and that's the illusion. That's why advertising works. When you go to the shops, or when you go and choose a car, or when you go and choose your clothes, why do you choose those things? I said the other day with some Bruno tobacco, why did I choose some Bruno tobacco? I thought I had a free choice there. Well, I didn't. I'd been completely conditioned. I'd completely sucked in by the advertisers. So when you actually go to the shops next time to buy something, just ask yourself, why am I buying this and not that? Who said I should buy this? See if you can actually track it down to some input, either from one of your friends said, "This is a really good product. This music is really good." It's from them. Or it's because of an advert you've seen on the television, or something you've seen in the newspaper. Sometimes it's quite shocks you, because again, we celebrate, we cherish our freedoms in the West, but they've all been manipulated, quite frankly. Every politician knows that, every advertising executive knows that, just how easy it is to manipulate people. Every guru knows, should know that, and they should be very careful not to do that, but to give people their freedom by pointing it out to people. Remember that wonderful scene in the life of Brian? When they asked Brian, so give him some teaching, and he said, "You are all different. was his teaching. And all these people shouted in unison, "We are all different." And they all really thought they were. So it's great. So that's anatta. And when you realize there's nobody in here, again, you stop complaining, you stop craving, you stop wanting things. The doer, or the illusion of doer, is gone. Then there's no more doing. When there's no more doing, soon there'll be no more being. The doer and the being go together. That's the way out of samsara. That is called the sunyata vimokkha. Sunyata, the emptiness liberation. In Buddhism, emptiness was always to do with non-self. It's the empty driver's seat. Yeah, go on. You've got it. Not only that, I conditioned you to come here, I conditioned you to pay, what, $250 also. I'm a great salesman. It's frightening, isn't it? But it's actually, you can see the truth in this. You can see it as many of you...